Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 23rd, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Well, this has been quite a week, characterized by the accelerating breakup of the unity of the Democratic Party behind the re-election of President Obama. The failed policies of this president and the recognition that the future under this puppet of the British Empire will be even more catastrophic, with the transatlantic financial system poised to implode with a full-scale hyperinflationary breakdown, beginning with the collapse of the euro, this process has led to a growing number of Democratic elected officials distancing themselves from him. Further, with the expanding swarm of scandals surrounding him, including the fast and furious gun-running operation and the bipartisan call for an investigation into the leaks from the White House of classified security intelligence, Obama's Emperor Nero personality has become more exposed. He is brittle, and he may be cracking up, as evidenced by his mistake, although he may not think it's a mistake, but his mistake in asserting executive privilege to hide evidence from the Congress in the Fast and Furious case. Also this week, we learned that former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker was deployed directly to counter the influence of Lyndon LaRouche, who is the leader of both the fight to remove President Obama and to restore Glass-Steagall as the first in a policy change to restore the economy of the United States. Volcker was explicitly deployed to prevent the restoration of Glass-Steagall. And the fraud of his Volcker rule in the so-called Dodd-Frank financial reform was exposed by the recent gambling losses of J.P. Morgan Chase. Given the situation, some people wonder, where does LaRouche's influence come from? They ask questions such as, who does he know? Is he some kind of billionaire? How is he at the center of this campaign to rescue civilization from the destruction coming from the insanity of the financial oligarchs who run the British Empire and control Obama as their puppet? On today's program, we'll take a peek behind the scenes, so to speak, to answer this question of what is the secret behind what appears to be the mysterious power of Lyndon LaRouche. As you will hopefully come to discover, if our panel does its job, and I'm sure it will, the secret lies in the power of the unleashing of the creative imagination. In a series of recent articles and video presentations on the LaRouche PAC Weekly Report, which appear in the June 15th EIR, LaRouche and several collaborators have introduced what he calls a lesson from Wilhelm Furtwängler, or the Furtwängler Principle, on the power of classical music. Joining me on the program today will be John Segerson, who has a long history with Mr. LaRouche in working on the methodology of music and musical performance, including the famous 1985 performance of Mozart's Requiem Mass to honor the late Indira Gandhi. Also, we have Matthew Ogden from LaRouche PAC TV, who is also a musician, who appeared with Mr. LaRouche on the three recent weekly reports on which this discussion took place, and Mihwa Steger, not surprisingly, another musician, an accomplished pianist and choral director, who's also leading the organizing drive in the San Francisco Bay Area to remove Obama and restore Glass-Steagall. Now, before I bring in our panel, a word of advice to our listeners. The secret of the power of classical composition and performance, which we will discuss today, cannot really be understood through mere spoken language. We will point to ideas which will require a great deal of work on your part if you wish to participate in the beautifully uplifting experience of actual creative work, which I might add is necessary today if we are going to rescue civilization. But I'm confident that by the end of this program, you will have gotten a glimpse into what is the basis of this creative power, which has propelled Lyndon LaRouche to the center of world statecraft. So Matthew, let me begin with you to do what I just said is impossible, tell us in language, what is the Furtwängler principle?
Hello, Harley. Happy to be on. Well, I think the way I'd like to begin is just to ask people to actually leave the domain of what they normally think of as music. Although we've just introduced this show as being on the subject of classical musical performance and composition, you actually won't understand the discussion that we're having here if you bring preconceived ideas of what you might think music is. One of the reasons for that is because over the last 100 years, especially since the end of the 19th century, since the death of Johannes Brahms, and since really the death of great scientific thinking as we know it, the way that people have thought about the universe has been bifurcated into two completely separate compartmentalized ways of thinking. On one side, people think about art, and on the other side, people think about science. And the reason why nobody today practically understands anything, and really why Mr. LaRouche stands head and shoulders above almost everybody else that you will meet as a living mind on this planet, is because of that very psychological problem. And it is a mental illness. It's the inability to integrate the entirety of the human being, the entirety of what it means to have the human being's relationship to another human being and the human being's relationship to the universe. And it has been intentionally a psychological disease that has been created in order to prevent people from understanding actually a principle which you may feel is being almost rediscovered right now. And that's something that Mr. LaRouche has asked recently. How many people actually, not just since the death of Wilhelm Furtwängler, but even while Wilhelm Furtwängler was alive, understood what the Furtwängler principle was? And not just as a mere artistic principle, but actually its full implications. So politically, what we need to be thinking about right now, and this is actually a discussion that Mr. LaRouche elaborated just this morning, in a discussion with some associates that I got to participate in, is that you need to clear away all of the accumulated habit, precedent, tradition, belief, everything that has been accumulated in terms of what you think about the world around you and what it means to even be a member of the human species, and actually think from outside of all that and with clear eyes and with a clear mind, see man for what he actually is. Because all the rest really is just circumstance. All the rest really is just shadow. And as Mr. LaRouche has asserted in a series of recent reports, which I would appeal to people to put the passionate energy into reading and understanding, a lesson from Wilhelm Furtwängler, The Universe Beyond, another one called Beyond Sense Perception, and then one more called What is Whose Law, is that the most immediate access point we have to experiencing the essence of what it means to just be human is in the classical music as it's performed and understood by Wilhelm Furtwängler, also another predecessor of Furtwängler, a conductor named Arthur Nikisch, and also in the father of all modern classical musical composition, Johann Sebastian Bach. Well, and this Matthew, really is... Go ahead.
Let me interrupt you there by posing a question to John on this, which is that what you just laid out and what Mr. LaRouche has been discussing is that music is not something that's primarily a sensory experience, although it is something we hear. So how do we get beyond what Matthew was just discussing? How do we get beyond the senses in order to really understand what musical composition is?
Oh, hi, Harley. Well, that's the whole purpose of what is known as counterpoint, something which has somewhat completely disappeared from the so-called music industry today. Because what you're listening for, just like in scientific work, what you're looking for is not sense sensory confirmation of what you already know, but looking for the contradictions, looking for everything that doesn't work, everything that doesn't fit, and trying to understand what the principle is that's behind that. And it's exactly the same thing with working with classical music as opposed to the popular forms, which are mostly all based just on direct sense perception and sincerity of feeling. So what you're listening for, and what Furtwängler is an absolute master on, is accentuating those contradictions, those paradoxes, those things that don't seem to fit. And one has to really retrain oneself to listen in that way to music, which is different than the way most people listen to music nowadays.
I would throw out to Mihwa, who as a pianist was brought up obviously to learn to play the notes. Obviously, there's something that you've discovered that exists in music that's not there in the notes per se, what Furtwängler calls between the notes. And I wonder, to what extent did you have to make new discoveries to be able to take your capabilities that you learned as a pianist to actually present musical ideas?
Well, what I would say on that is that I had to submit my creative endeavors to people that had come before me, people, standard setters, people like Bach. And I think this is where Furtwängler really became educated on the question of between the notes, because within something like a Bach prelude or fugue, you get a density of action and of change that you cannot at any moment be within just a sense perceptual, you know, literal sequence of events, but you actually rise above it, completely outside the senses. And this goes to what Matt was bringing up, where true music isn't really the domain of music, but it's a domain of ideas, which Furtwängler was highly committed to.
Well, and I'll throw this out to anyone, because I think what we need to do is just actually be responding to each other to carry through this discussion. But when you look at this, there are a number of things that Mr. LaRouche has pointed to in his writings in terms of the idea of time, which has been brought up here. Also, this question of the relationship of the microcosm to the macrocosm, the whole to the parts. And I think what we're looking at in discussing this, as all of you have referenced, is a retraining to take us above the senses. Now, this gets at something that's also central to LaRouche's discussion, which is that man is not primarily a creature of the senses, but a different kind of life form. So I'd like to throw those things out and see what kind of things you have to say on that.
I can jump in on the question of taking example like the Well-Tempered Clavier of Bach, which, you know, he writes the first set in the 1720s and then the second set 20 years later. And the unique experience of working through these profound ideas is that you are subjectively working through the hypotheses and struggles and resolutions that Bach undergoes. And you realize it's a very specific mission to understand what the human mind is and how the essence of creativity is truly expressed. And the wonderful thing about actually comparing the two books is you see the development. You actually experience and go through yourself the development that he makes in the second book. And personally, I've been investigating this. There was one specifically, maybe John and Matt, even you, Harley, can take a look at it in the audience. I invite to look at it. But there is something very unique that I'm discovering about the A minor prelude and fugue. And it was one thing that struck out to me, that you have Bach dealing with, it's personality of keys. And I think people have a very strange sense of keys these days because they sort of think that it communicates just a mood. But a personality and sense of character, I think, is very different than just an emotional mood. But what he is able to achieve in the second book is much more lucid, and for a singer, for somebody that conducts a chorus or for somebody that really sings, has a sense that it's a true freedom of counterpoint that he, I don't think, was able to. He was struggling a little bit more in the first book.
John, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on the first four of book one and book two, and I can only confirm what Miwa is pointing at, that the book two, the book one is characterized by really, I mean, he's younger. It's bold. He has bold ideas which are pushed through and set forward. Then in book two, the intensity is multiplied, and everything is completely. And when a new idea is introduced, it's not sort of, it's done in a way that's totally and utterly prepared. And this idea of preparation is an anticipation, I think, is one thing that's critical, because when you talk about preparation, anticipation, all of these kinds of things, you're talking about something that is an intention that's in the future, which gets to this question of time. Mm-hmm. Because, and you hear this in Furtwängler. Just the other day I was listening to comparing various recordings of Schumann's Fourth Symphony, which Furtwängler conducted in 1953, but I mean, it's one of the most conducted and recorded symphonies that you can imagine. And it's totally striking with Furtwängler is this question that it lives in the future, and at no moment do you feel like you're coming from the past. You're hurrying towards the future in great anticipation, like. Well, it's in the Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, "Wie ein Held zum Siegen," like a hero onward to victory. And there's never a point at which you feel like it's just the notes, that you're just presenting something that's already been done. I think that Bach is in the second book is the quintessence of that kind of preparation. And I might say, in terms of Furtwängler, just as aside, is that he, when he was working under Nikisch, his mentor, one of his major struggles was how to get the effect of this with a well-trained orchestra, because it's not just technique that you're talking about. However, it needs to be communicated often through technique, i.e. the way that the conductor appears in front of the orchestra and the way he comports himself, what he does with moving his hands. And nowadays, of course, everybody talks about beats, and you have the beat, and you see these conductors who just basically wave their baton with the beat in various odd ways. But Furtwängler had a whole different idea about this, which was quite infamous, or famous, because the way some people would put it is his beat is hard to follow, and if you see any video clips of him, you'll see this. His hand motions are really quite unique, and they're meant to create paradoxes. And as he says in his own discussions, they're meant to create this kind of anticipation.
How do you communicate that to an orchestra? I mean, obviously this is something that requires a communication of an idea that's not in the music or in the hand motions.
Oh yeah, well it's a shared idea, and the problem that we have today is that you could have a Furtwängler, somebody who was just who was as gifted and as much of a genius at Furtwängler, and he would get up into to many modern orchestras today and he would not get the right effect because the musicians themselves have lost this sense of what this Furtwängler principle is all about. So you need with the orchestra a shared sense and there of this, and there's no better example of that than Furtwängler with his own symphony, the Berlin Philharmonic, which he lived with and ate with and worked with. And I mean, they knew each other so well, and they held together, and so that he wasn't just a guest there, and they weren't just tolerating him. I mean, that's what happens with a lot of modern orchestras today, is the orchestra members sort of tolerate the conductor. Or else, the other one is that you'll have the conductor who's an egomaniac, of which there are many. And again, they'll go along with the egomania. I mean, Bernstein was typical of that kind of egomania. But also in his own way, Herbert von Karajan, the Nazi who the Allies pushed as an alternative to Furtwängler in the most despicable way. So, and which was, and the members of the Berlin Philharmonic who had von Karajan forced on them after Furtwängler died in 1954, talk about how shocking it was when they had the difference between the two. And that's another thing about Furtwängler, the Furtwängler principle, which I just want to emphasize with respect to the influence that he had on Lyndon LaRouche. These are great people. Furtwängler is a great person. Lyndon LaRouche is a truly great individual. And nowadays you're not supposed to have great individuals, right? That's a little bit, you know, you're supposed to have good guys. And
you like.
Yeah, people who are nice guys. And the difficulty is that to think that these people emanate a tremendous amount of influence and amongst all the people who are around them. And it's almost a magical thing. And members of the Berlin Philharmonic talked about this, that literally Furtwängler could walk in a room. He wouldn't even be conducting. He could walk in a room, and all of a sudden there was a change. It was like a physical change in the room.
And you're listening to the LaRouche Show. Today we're talking about the Furtwängler principle, and let me refer people again to the June 15th, 2012 issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, which has Lyndon LaRouche's article on a lesson from Wilhelm Furtwängler, and then the transcripts of three of the weekly reports that were done on LaRouche Pack TV. So you can go to LaRouche Pack and watch these reports, which I think would be very useful, as well as being able to read them and work through these ideas. Now, there are a number of questions that came up from just listening to what you just said, John, but I want to go back to something else in the groundwork first that, Matthew, you spoke about in the weekly report, which is the question that John raised of the anticipated tone, the non-heard tone or the silence, also the near hearing versus the far hearing. If you could just present a couple of these ideas to give people a sense of how this fits in with this idea of going beyond the sense perception of hearing.
Well, let me try to get at it in a specific way. As I mentioned, you know, Mr. LaRouche is working on a new report, and he actually says in this paper that what he's coming to right now will probably turn out to have been the most important of his life's work thus far. And let me ask a question so that people actually feel the impact of what we're really talking about here. If you ask yourself truthfully, how can a human being actually discover the proof of his own existence? And this is what Mr. LaRouche has been trying to address. As long as you are trapped within the prison of sense experience, and as long as you take your idea that objects as such, as you sense them, through the chemical, biological, physical, mere chemistry of human beings' sense perception, and then try to take those as elementary objects or as infinitesimal parts, and then try to build a universe out of it as a complex, as a mathematical complex concatenation of these individual objects as such, you never reach the proof of the existence of your own mind. You never reach the proof of the existence of man. It's only great minds, and Lyndon LaRouche is saying this literally, Furt Wengler's discovery actually may prove to have been one of the greatest breakthroughs in modern physical science. When we're talking about, and I don't want to just summarize something because it's been presented in scientifically rigorous detail in these three trilogy of weekly reports, but it's only once you say, no, there's a relationship, yes, between the substance and the shadow, but what we sense as mere sense impression, both as matter, as material, and also as time, as any given moment in time, is just a shadow of the ontologically real substance which is casting that shadow. This was the domain in which Furt Wengler was actually working and thinking, and his music is an experimental expression of an understanding that he had, but the constant reciprocal, dynamically mutual relationship between the parts and the whole, or between the moment and the eternal, or between mortality and immortality. And this is the kind of, this is the frontier, this is the highest expression, the highest form of human mental life yet, that we as a species have yet to experience. And it's actually the only way that we're going to solve the kinds of almost, you know, we've eliminated the possibility of our own existence in the terms of what we define as what reality is, within the prison walls of what we call sense experience. I'd like to develop that more, and I know that we'll be getting into that at some of the upcoming weekly reports, but I'd like to place the subject of the discussion sort of from that point.
Well, it's interesting because the way you put it is what Lyndon LaRouche has always emphasized in scientific work, is that you're looking at the paradoxes. You're looking at the friction that exists between various qualities of existence, and realizing that this is actually something which is the defining character of the universe, as opposed to the what we usually are think we're looking at when we look at scientific questions. So, Matthew, John, Mihua, anyone, just jump in at this point, because I think this begins to get at this question of the real subject of our program today, which is that how do we take what we can get from a creative personality such as Furt Wengler or Lyndon LaRouche and use these ideas and principles to change the culture? Because this culture isn't going to make it. This culture has tolerated an Obama. It's tolerated the Euro. It's tolerated a destruction of these creative principles. So go ahead.
Well, let me just say on that, something that was very provocative in Furt Wengler's Concerning Music, the first chapter of his book, where he goes through the concept of creating a genuine community. And as an organizer, as a conductor, as a musician, I've been able to get a multi-parameter approach to what this really means, because people in the population right now are encountering a true paradox. And it's a true paradox about what their role is going to be in shaping the future, because they see that they're confronted with, again, in this next election, a choice between the best of the worst. And nobody wants to do that. Everybody that we're meeting realizes that that is a death wish, and that they're completely looking for something that can determine the future and how they can play a role in that. And so this just reminds me of the role that somebody like Bach or Furtwängler has to play for us. And when I've worked through Bach, you realize, just to bring up what John had brought up before, on the question of the anticipation, it is truly a metaphor for you to realize that you are always within the context of musical ideas and a real commitment to communicate these ideas. You're always living in the future. And your mind is allowing, the idea that you have in your mind is pulling you towards the future. Just as our policy initiative right now on the question of NUWAPA and Glass-Steagall is something that is a future orientation that can move us out of this mess, you know, the hyperinflationary collapse that we've got. And so, just to go back to Furtwängler's question of the genuine community, he really saw the role that he was playing. And I mean, don't forget that, you can't separate the period in which he was conducting. This is a highly tumultuous, intense political period. And there was a committed effort to communicate the ideas that we have a responsibility as musicians to do, as human beings. We have to continue to uproot the standards. And push the standards far above where we are. So he really saw it as a people today see themselves as sort of a separate entity from what's happening in the world. But this is the real role, and this is what I learned from Lynn, because I consider Lynn the best musician known to me, and I've never heard him play, which is a paradox in and of itself.
I have. Very briefly.
Well, you're lucky, probably. But just to finish what I was going to say, that Lynn has continuously emphasized that the role of classical culture is what is able going to educate our population to make the best decision. That is how we condition our soul and our spirit.
Go ahead, John. I know you have something on that.
Yeah, I want to, again, building on what Miho was saying, I wanted to point out one other, one way that that people who are listening have to think about in order to get a handle on what we're saying, which is this question of passion. Because nowadays, I mean, we see it, the misplacement of passion is one of our biggest problems today. I mean, we see it in the how fleeting marriage is, for instance. People, you know, I've seen this so many times. People get married and then 1 week afterwards they say, "Oh, well, I'm bored already," and that's it. That's that. It's amazing. It's hard to believe. But it's because of this misplacement of passion or a lack of, or really a very superficial idea of passion. What Furtwängler is getting at is a true sense of passion in terms of your sense of a sense of your immortality by your actions, and it's that quality of passion to be able not passionateness about little things, but a passion, the kind of passion that Joan of Arc felt for saving France, is one of the best ways that I can think of at it. That is, everybody else thought she was totally insane for being a peasant girl who said, "I have to go and I am taking on the responsibility to save France." But that was her passion, and this was not just a personal passion of something. This was a passion for an idea, because it wasn't just that she was saving France for what it was, but she had an idea of what the France of the future, a true nation state, ought to be, and that was what inspired future rulers like Louis XI and Henry VII in Britain to form the first nation states, which unfortunately got ruined subsequently by Venetian operations. But But it was that quality. It's that quality of passion to save humanity, and right now that is absolutely necessary in order for us to get anything done today. What always comes to mind is this little poem by Schiller, Friedrich Schiller, which is called Sehnsucht, is called yearning, and I'll just do it in English. The last part of it says, you have to believe, you have to dare, because the gods do not give you any guarantee. Only a miracle will take you into the beautiful land of miracles. By which he means that miracle is exactly this miraculous power that LaRouche is talking about, and that is shared by Nikisch and Furtwängler. It's that power. It's that passion for truth, and but not just specific truth, but the truth of who we are as a species. You really have to get a sense of that passion. You have to hear. It's important to be able to hear some of these Furtwängler these recordings, which give you a window on what it must have been like to have been there.
And we will be posting references. I think, Matthew, you said we're going to have a page on the website where people can go to find things they can listen to.
Yeah, on the LaRouche Pack website, we have assembled the three videos that were the first three in the series of weekly reports on this subject, and both including references which I may have brought up, but also things that Jason Ross brought up in the course of his parallel presentations on the similar understanding of exactly the same principle from Bernard Riemann. There's going to be further reading material, also just links that you can follow to listen to some of this music, and also in this series of EIR articles that you brought up, Harley, we have sort of elaborated those transcripts of the weekly reports with citations and footnotes so that people can follow through and do some continued research on their own.
Well, Matt, let me come back to something. What John said just reminded me of something you were bringing up earlier in terms of this question of the highest form of mental life. There's a question we got in from Essen, Germany, from people who are listening there to the program. They wrote in that Lynn said that what Furtwängler accomplished was not accomplished before. And they asked the question, how is his scientific discovery that you've been discussing different from previous discoveries? What was it that was discovered?
Well, I'd say that you have to begin to think about what it actually means to be a creator. And, you know, the problem I think that people tend to run into with so-called science is that it's an objective thing. It's something that you look at from the outside, but are not necessarily understanding from the standpoint of being in the shoes of the creator himself. Now, great scientists like Johannes Kepler, for example, did not take that approach. I mean, Kepler's proof of his own discovery of the harmonic ordering of the planets in the solar system was actually taking away, after having come up with his entire hypothesis, then taking away all sense perception, closing his eyes, and actually trying to create the universe again, as if he was God. And then the fact that he could create that same universe as he knew it, which was the solar system, the orbits of these planets, according to the harmonic principles which he had discovered, proved to him that he was thinking the thoughts of God. And we also have heard the same phrase from Albert Einstein, which is not a coincidence, because Einstein himself was a great musician. Now, I would just say that it's this kind of way of thinking to be able to say, well, let's see man for what he is, not just in the clothes that he wears, but see what man for what he is as a matter of existence, which is really what change do we create in an internally developing, self-bounded universe, which we are of the same substance with, not standing as if from the outside, like the way that people think about science, so-called, but actually as a creator, as a Promethean. And it's the very unique thing about Furtwängler is that his discoveries, his scientific discoveries, or you could even say, they raise beyond just what people think of as science, which is like, oh, I like biology or I like physics. But these are ontological discoveries about the characteristic of the universe. He discovered from inside art. He discovered from inside of his experience as a creator and a recreator. From the standpoint of a total immersion, you know, mind, body, and soul with a religious quality of love to it. And it was his intense experience from the inside of that allowed him to make the discoveries that he did make. And now, I'd also say, you know, that his looking backwards onto, for example, Bach, and clarifying what it was that actually made Bach the revolutionary father of all modern classical musical composition, you know, this actually allows us to look at Bach's music with new eyes and to develop this even further than what necessarily even others before Furtwängler had understood about the importance of what Bach had accomplished. So you're looking at a reciprocation, and I think, you know, also what Mr. LaRouche himself has brought to bear on drawing out the full implications of what Furtwängler discovered, this develops even further what the implications for science and for our view of the universe of the Furtwängler principle is.
I was just going to say that if you, I believe it was Lyndon LaRouche who wrote about this when he said that you had Kepler and Leibniz, who in a sense were part of the same scientific breakthroughs that were represented by Bach. And then he made the reference of the influence of Max Planck and Einstein on Furtwängler. And John, when we were talking last night about this question of creating a culture, you came back to this in terms of what it takes in terms of an individual creative discoverer to change the culture. I wonder if you can elaborate on that a little.
Well, I was just thinking about that question from Essen, and the fact is that this was a long gestation period, and indeed he made these discoveries pretty much at the same time, or maybe just a few years afterwards that Einstein made his discoveries. So they are perfectly in parallel, in terms of the nature of the universe. I'm not quite. Could you repeat the?
Well, I was just talking about this question that Mihwa brought up in Furtwängler's own writing about creating a genuine community.
Yeah.
That in effect, this is what Lin has launched with his scientific cultural work in our movement. You know, to replicate the kind of environment that existed between the period of Kepler, Leibniz, and Bach, Planck, Einstein, and Furtwängler, which with the, as he says, I think, in the writings, with the death of Brahms, it hasn't been there in music, and in the recent period, because of the Bertrand Russell and Norbert Wiener and others who reject the idea of the universal principles, you've had a destruction of science.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same, and it's based on this exactly the same problem that LaRouche has brought up, which is this idea that of building things up from the parts, because typical today in music is this crazy original music cult where everything has to be just exactly the way the composer intended it, but that actually. I would say that most composers who would listen to these recordings would probably say, wait a minute, that had nothing to do with what I intended. Mm-hmm. Because indeed what they're doing is they've got this imaginary idea of something that's original and historical, and all the life has been taken out of it. And it's precisely because they're building it up from all of the details of historical so-called historical research. And they say, well, the sum total of all these little drib-drabs that they've gotten from reading this little part, this little piece and that little piece from the 18th to the 19th century, that somehow they put this all together, and this is so-called being historically informed. And Furtwängler says in his writings, he says, this is the most ridiculous thing in the world, because the main thing that the composer intends you to do is to recreate something which is living, an actual living piece, that's an organically living piece, and to bring it alive to the audience that you have right there, in the time that you have, and in the space that you have right there, and with the orchestra that you have right there. And so therefore nothing is fixed in terms of the way that the violins have to play or something like that, or the specific instruments that need the way they need to be constructed. Although I might add that one thing that will help a lot in our ability to get this done is reinstituting the lower tuning at C256, which was a back and forth during Furtwängler's time. Actually, I discovered a 1952 recording of the St. Matthew Passion that Furtwängler did, which is, at least on the record, is at the lower tuning. Exactly why, I'm not sure. I'm still looking into that. But it's amazing to hear the voices working at the lower tuning, and it will be much easier and much more fun to reconstruct these ideas at the proper tuning of around C256.
Nihua, I think you were going to say something.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate what John just brought up, because when you're conducting, when you've got a group of people standing in front of you and you're all fighting for an idea, you are submitting yourself to an idea that's already been created, a standard that's been created, that you have to really fight against the tendency, which is reflected in our culture today, to just sort of arrange parts. And Furtwängler calls it something like arranging a vase of flowers. But with the music, and I can speak from my own personal standpoint, when I'm at the keyboard and I'm working through a Bach fugue, it does, if you submit yourself to what Bach is doing, and the hypotheses that Bach is making, it takes on a life of its own. And you're completely submitted to that. And so the organic quality of the creation, at every moment you are creating and recreating what's already been created, is highly profound. And I think that, you know, we can't separate it from, I don't think Furtwängler did either, from the era that we exist in, that we have to fight to change this culture and to bring it back to a culture of profound ideas. And that will bring the passion back. It's going to create the organic passion that is necessary to really move somebody and move somebody's spirit.
Well, let me bring up in the last 10 or so minutes of the program something that is also very much central to LaRouche's focus, which is the relationship between music and economic forecasting, music as a scientific principle and his ability to forecast. We've touched on this a little bit, but Matthew, this is one of the major points of, I think it was the third of the, or maybe it was the second of the three-part weekly reports you did. I'd like you to say something on that.
Yes, I will. What people have to understand is that the future is an efficient reality. It exists prior to our experience of it. And this will be something that will be shouted down as soon as you try to assert this. The reductionist will say, you can't say that. How can something exist if we haven't experienced it yet? And this is exactly the problem that we face when we're talking about the prison walls of sense experience. So this is what we're actually beginning to get into with what the Furtwängler principle implies, because you cannot understand the cause of any given moment of a process. You cannot understand the cause of any material thing from within the standpoint of that material thing. As I've emphasized on these weekly reports, Leibniz asserted that, definitively. And that really is the standpoint from which, even as Mr. LaRouche himself has said, his whole outlook on the universe was formed. Reading Leibniz at the age of 14 and then encountering Furtwängler, at the age of 21, 22. So you cannot derive the cause of any object's existence from within that object itself, within that finite thing, nor from even the aggregate of all finite things. It's only from outside, a dominant substance which lies outside any of those finite things, that you can find the cause of that substance. Now, what does that imply, though, when you're talking about, for example, a piece of music, where any given moment is, a note or a phrase or a moment of sense experience? Not within any of those moments can you find the cause of that moment's being. So the only place you can find that cause is from the standpoint of the whole. And Furtwängler says this explicitly. He says, the whole dictates the behavior of every single part. There is a mutual reciprocation between the parts and the whole, but the whole is primary. Now, where does the whole exist? Or you can even ask, when does the whole exist? And we anticipate that at the completion of a piece of music, there will echo the impression of that whole. But during the course of the performance of that music, if that future time, if that future whole upon completion has not yet come into experienced existence, how can that whole be dictating the behavior of all the parts? And that's where we're talking about with this relationship, as Mr. LaRouche has picked up on it, between the near and the far. Furtwängler used the term Fernhören, which means hearing something at the distance, and Nahhören, which means hearing something in the moment. And always having a collision between those two, listening from the future to the present, and listening from the present to the future. Now, that is the question of economic forecasting is nothing but that. And it's also not just a forecasting question from the standpoint of an armchair forecaster who's looking sort of in the future and saying, here's my analysis of what's going to be. It's also from the standpoint of what Linda LaRouche is even more fundamentally, which is not just a forecaster, but a creator, a Promethean, somebody who's always bringing the future into existence, which has to be a new species all the time, not something that's derived from present experience. And Mr. LaRouche has said this clearly, that the error of economic forecasting comes from statistics, coming from what's so-called plausible, saying, I'm going to try to define the future in the terms of the present. And he said, absolutely no. The future can only be defined in its own terms, because the future is always a new species relative to what we've experienced in the present and the past.
And it's the same, and to just chime in on that, it's exactly the same thing in scientific research, because what we're plagued with this crazy idea about randomness and random development, which is so prevalent in the scientific community, that somehow organized structures come from random motion on a statistical basis. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter, the minute that you see something which seems to be random, if you and we have done this in our work in the basement, you simply keep stepping back and you find that no, indeed, anything that is random in this universe is only apparently so.
Right, and I'll jump in on that. I mean, the way that this randomness, this chaos theory, probability theory was enforced was taking the discoveries of Max Planck and perverting them. What Max Planck discovered about the quantum, and then saying, well, there's paradoxes on the level of the quantum that can't be explained from the standpoint of cause-effect linear chronology, that something that happens in the now then creates kinematically the result or the effect that happens at the next moment, and so on and so forth. And that was used to enforce this idea of randomness and chaos theory. Rather, Einstein, a great musician himself, said famously, well, the problem here is not that we have to throw out causality. The problem is here we have to redefine our idea of causality. And he used the analogy of saying, this is like the amateur pianist sitting down and saying, well, when I play a piece of music, one note follows the next and causes the next one to happen. He said, no, we have to change our idea of causality, and it's much more of an understanding of causality like that what we experience with a Bach fugue.
Yep. Well, I'll jump in on that and communicate that it's very, the question of randomness, what you get with a Bach fugue is a high-level quality and metaphor of organization, an organization and composition of the universe. And you're getting a direct representation of how the human mind functions based on a reflection of a principle. Because the human mind, what we do is directly manifested into the physical universe, and you can get an actual response and reaction. But the ordering principle is what is completely necessary, and why we have to bring back the investigations, high-level investigations, into the fugues, because it's our best proof as to how our mind should function.
One qualification on that: make sure that you're not listening to the fugues as played by Glenn Gould, because you'll get a perfect example of randomness.
Well, John, let me ask, is there any performance that you would recommend of the Bach Preludes and Fugues from the Well-Tempered Clavier?
Well, I think Andras Schiff's are very good, are really paradigmatic, his Andras Schiff's performances of that. But I might also say that Edwin Fischer's performances are also very, very well worth studying. He was a close friend of Furtwängler.
Just very quickly, because we were almost out of time, and I can see why we need at least 3 to 4 more weekly reports to discuss this, Matthew, just to throw in my 2 cents on that, because there's so many other questions. But obviously there was a political attack against Furtwängler, accusing him or putting him through denazification. What did he have a protege? Was there anybody who followed Furtwängler, or was this really the attack on him designed to destroy the tradition?
Well, I can say just about the attack itself, I think there's actually some very fascinating things about that John and I have actually sort of stumbled across and just throwing things back and forth on this. It really does turn out that Furtwängler had a much more significant role in the resistance to Hitler than most people will give him credit for, and most people even realize. The denazification thing is important, because that came straight from the CCF and from the Anglo-American...
Congress for Cultural Freedom.
Yes, the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And, actually one of the people who defended him the closest was his friend and fellow musician Yehudi Menuhin,
right,
who said, this is total hypocrisy. He said, you know, the very people who are going after Furtwängler right now for not leaving Germany, and so therefore he was part of the Nazi effort, so-called, these people out of London are the people who appeased Hitler for 7 years and who refused to open a Western front on Nazi Germany during the course of the 5 years of World War II. So that hypocrisy actually gets at the root of something which I think is very fascinating and has to be researched further. But Hitler, at the end of his life, you know, in 1945, actually did pursue Furtwängler and tried to send him to a concentration camp, although Furtwängler had persisted for several years. Hitler actually accused him of being part of the coup to overthrow the Hitler regime in 1945. There was an assassination plot, and this was foiled, and the people involved were assassinated.
And that, Matthew, we're going to have to end because we've run out of time. But I hope that in listening to this program, you begin to get a sense of what Lyndon LaRouche has opened up as a flank for the future. That is the intersection of music and science as reflections of a universal creative principle. And I think I'm certain that at some point we'll reconstitute this panel to take this discussion a little bit further. So you've been listening to The LaRouche Show. Join us next Saturday at 3 p.m. and we'll take up another scintillating and absolutely urgent topic that will determine whether or not we're going to survive. So thank you very much, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you.